Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week's podcast is once again about Russia's war against Ukraine, but this time we won't be discussing the battlefield situation, the diplomacy, or the talk about talks. Instead, we'll be focusing on the origins of the war and of the full-scale invasion that Russia launched in February 2022. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is the perfect person to talk about this. Lucian Kim is the author of a new book titled Putin's Revenge, Why Russia Invaded Ukraine, which was released just last week. Now senior analyst for Ukraine at the Crisis Group, Lucian is a journalist who has reported on Ukraine and Russia since Putin's first presidential term, which started about a quarter century ago in 2000. Lucian was based in Moscow and Berlin for more than 20 years, and our paths crossed at times during that period. Thanks very much for joining me, Lucian.
Great to be here with you, Steve.
All right. It's great to have you on the show. I'm going to mention in the introduction to your book, I'll start with this. You write that before the full-scale invasion began, before the attack on February 24th, 2022, quote, the idea of a full-scale invasion seemed insane, unquote. And also that the war in Ukraine was ultimately a product of Putin's mind and his unchecked dictatorial powers. Now, my own view is that Putin's decision to launch the full-scale invasion was motivated mainly by resentment. To me, it seems like almost maybe something like 90%, along with his feelings about Ukraine or his views that had been developed over decades. Maybe you could comment on whether that seems accurate, but I guess a more straightforward question, and I don't know if there's a way to answer it more briefly, would be a variation on the subtitle of your book, Why Russia Invaded Ukraine. So why did Russia invade Ukraine?
Well, first I'd like to say that I agree with you, Steve, that it is, to a large part, resentment that drove Putin to start the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And in some ways, resentment and revenge are very closely related. But for a short answer to the question of why did Russia invade Ukraine, I see several reasons or several drivers. And the main driver is the legacy of Russian imperialism, whether it's in the guise of the Russian Empire that existed for 300 years or the Soviet Union or now the Russian Federation. There's kind of an underlying thread during all those different states that sees Russia as the core of a great Eurasian empire. And that legacy was not defeated when the Soviet Union fell apart. And for many people, it was, as you say, a great cause for resentment that did, in fact, happen. I do see another driver as well. The other driver is the kind of country that post-communist Russia became. There were great hopes that Russia could, for the first time in its history, become a democracy. And instead, under Vladimir Putin's rule, it took a very sharp turn towards autocracy. And I would certainly argue that the more autocratic Russia became, the more likely this war became as well. When Putin first took office in 2000, I don't think he had any designs on invading Ukraine. That was not part of some grand plan. But the longer he stayed in office, the more paranoid he became about his own rule. And he saw Ukraine sort of as a gateway to Russia for a hostile West, in his view. I would also say that there were other factors. It's not like the West did not play any role or does not carry any responsibility for what eventually turned into the full-scale invasion. And by that, I mean George W. Bush's initial drive after the disastrous Iraq War to bring Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. This was, in his view, a sort of reward for their participation in the coalition of the willing. Ukraine and Georgia both sent troops to Iraq to help the American occupation. And in 2008, he tried to bring both of those countries closer into NATO by offering them membership action plans. And this started, of course, a split in NATO because Germany and France were unwilling to, they thought those countries were not ready to join NATO, and they were also very concerned with how Russia might react. I should also say that Ukrainians themselves did not want to go into NATO. The majority of Ukrainians were not interested in NATO membership in 2008. It was a very different place at the time. Russia was seen as sort of a partner country, certainly not possibly a rival, but certainly not as an enemy. And so in those days, because the West opened the door to NATO membership, at least put it on the agenda in Ukraine, that raised certain expectations. In Russia, that stoked certain fears. And the tragedy here is that the West never had any intention of letting Ukraine into NATO and nor into the EU. But it made Ukraine extremely vulnerable to an increasingly revanchist Russia.
Thanks, Lucian. And I'll probably dwell on this a little bit more in a second question a little later. But, you know, you mentioned the George W. Bush hoping to extend the membership action plan for NATO to Georgia and Ukraine. And then, as it turned out, as you said, Germany and France were opposed to that. And then there was this compromise agreement at the NATO summit in Bucharest in 2008, which ended up, I think, in a lot of people's views, being, you know, almost worse than either of the alternatives. So the decision that was made was to tell Ukraine and Georgia that they would eventually be members. So, you know, there was no timeline for that. It was essentially just in the future, sometime you'll be NATO members. But I think Putin, you know, it's hard to say, in my opinion, whether Putin believes a lot of what he says. But it seems like Putin and Russia in general took that as kind of, you know, not a compromise. I mean, but in fact, a way of, you know, of saying you'll be in NATO. So and so that may have been one of the reasons that all of this happened. I mean, there was the invasion of Georgia and then of Ukraine. I mean, do you see that as kind of a defining moment?
Absolutely. I devote quite a bit of time to the Bucharest summit in 2008, and it was definitely, I agree with you, it was kind of the worst of both worlds. It's not NATO membership, right? And it's also not being completely outside. And this created the impression, I think, in the Kremlin that NATO membership was becoming inevitable for both of those countries. There's some debate whether, you know, if NATO had in 2008 offered a so-called membership action plan, meaning a concrete roadmap into the alliance, some people believe that this would have deterred Russia from invading Georgia and later going after Ukraine. I doubt that. I think that was a kind of semantics for the Kremlin. They heard that Ukraine and Georgia will eventually become members of NATO, and that was enough for them. And that's why this idea of, you know, the security guarantees before you become a member are incredibly important. And we saw that when Sweden and Finland joined NATO after the full-scale invasion, they did already get security guarantees even before they became full-scale members.
Right. Okay, thanks for that as well. And I just want to, before I'm asking the second question, I just wanted to go back a little to the idea of kind of Russian imperialism and the attitudes that sort of persisted, as you said, I think, you know, during the empire and the Soviet Union. And then I feel like Putin, you know, they made these demands before the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Russia made demands. I mean, they called them proposals, but essentially it was kind of a return to something, not the Warsaw Pact, where Russia would control Eastern Europe, but essentially, you know, weakening NATO and increasing or restoring a fair amount of Russian influence over not just Ukraine and other former Soviet republics to the west of Russia, but also former Warsaw Pact nations in Central and Eastern Europe. And I feel like Putin always has sort of believed that it was enough for Russia to kind of renounce communism. But it seems like from what he's said at times, he feels like, okay, Soviet Union collapsed, communism collapsed, but we should still control, you know, large areas of land west of Russia. Do you see that as kind of a persistent, almost feeling of entitlement that has affected this war?
Well, probably everyone has heard this famous saying by Putin that the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I think he meant it in different ways. I mean, in one sense, he meant in the context of that quote, he was actually talking about the amount of ethnic Russians who found themselves outside of Russia when that happened.
Yes.
But I think in a much broader sense, when we talk about the catastrophe of the fall of the Soviet Union, this is not about Putin, you know, missing communism. This is about empire at its core. And this is what I tried to allude to in the beginning, right? It does not matter whether this was the Russian Empire or the Soviet Union. There's this continuing idea that Russia should control this huge landmass in Eurasia. I mean, from a geopolitical point of view, you could even justify it, right? It's a landmass that has, you know, no oceans, no huge bodies of water, no impenetrable mountain ranges. So in that sense, you know, you could certainly make the argument that would make sense from a geopolitical point of view. But when he said, you know, this was the greatest catastrophe in the 20th century, he was really thinking of the empire that existed, let's say, during the Cold War. And this was the largest reach of Russian power ever. It reached from Prague in the west all the way to Pyongyang in North Korea. And the Russian Empire had never had such an incredible reach. So I think it was missing that and feeling, again, if the use of the word catastrophe also goes back to this idea of resentment. Vladimir Putin, as a young KGB officer, was based in East Germany, and he saw these huge people power revolutions in East Germany and in neighboring Czechoslovakia bring down the communist regime. And the Soviet Union, with all its military might and its nuclear weapons, was unable to do anything. And I think this caused a great trauma for him personally. But it was certainly a trauma that was shared by millions of other Russians.
All right, thanks. And some of this we'll probably get into some of these same themes, but I'm going to base my second question or this question on the title of your book, Putin's Revenge. I guess the overall question would be, revenge for what? We've discussed this a bit, but let me expand on that. Towards the beginning of the book, you touch on several key events or milestones, I guess, in Putin's thinking, or milestones in Putin's thinking, or events on the ground involving Ukraine and the West. These go back as far as Putin's time as a KGB officer in East Germany, which you just mentioned, where he witnessed these peaceful pro-democracy protests, as you say in your book, sweep away Soviet puppet regimes in East Berlin and Prague, unquote, 2 years after before the Soviet Union itself fell apart. And then moving forward, other milestones, well, just a few, include the September 11th, 2001 attacks on the United States, which Putin really kind of grabbed at as he was the first leader to call Bush, I guess, and offer support. And he saw that as a real way to make an alliance against what he saw as terrorism, you know, with the U.S. Other events, the enlargement of NATO as the Warsaw Pact countries and the Baltics joined the alliance. And we mentioned the 2008 NATO summit in Bucharest. And then also a little bit before that was the 2004 Orange Revolution in Ukraine. And 10 years later, the Maidan protests and the downfall of Moscow-friendly President Viktor Yanukovych, after which Russia occupied Crimea and set off the war in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine. So sorry to go through all these, but is there any particular development, I guess, over the past 35 years that you think had a kind of an outsized influence on Putin and led maybe more than others to the full-scale invasion of Ukraine? Or is it more a combination of factors? And a related question is whether Putin's misreading of certain events or of the motives of others in Ukraine and the West may have led to the invasion.
Sure. I do think it's a combination of events. It's a cumulative process. As I mentioned before, Putin didn't come into office in 2000 planning some huge invasion of Ukraine. Right. This is a process that he went through as a ruler, and probably just as a human being. The more power that he accumulated, and the smaller and tighter his inner circle became, you know, his state of mind changed as well. So, I think, you know, the question is revenge for what? That's certainly a very justified question. The first thing I would say is, you know, you don't need to get revenge on someone who necessarily did something bad to you. You can imagine this, or you can be insulted and hurt and seek revenge. It doesn't mean that there was necessarily an offense or any offense meant. And I would say this particularly in regards to Ukraine. This is revenge against Ukrainians who wanted to seek their future and their country's future with the West. This is pure and simple revenge, sort of punishment. It is also, I would say, to a very large degree, revenge against the West. And here, there are a lot of perceived slights and humiliations. Maybe some of them were also real. Certainly, I mean, you mentioned certain key events. NATO expansion was certainly one of them. He was opposed to it, and one should say that even as far as we understand, Boris Yeltsin was not Vladimir Putin's predecessor was also not enthusiastic about it. Maybe more because of the domestic fallout that would have in Russia, but we know that Vladimir Putin was also opposed to it. Although, again, at the beginning of his rule, he did not rule out Russia joining NATO. At the time, it might have seemed also far-fetched, but, you know, he was holding out this possibility. And I think in the beginning, when people couldn't really assess who Vladimir Putin was, there was an idea that Russia was on a democratic path and that a democratic Russia could find a place in NATO. That was not out of the question. And I think this also goes a little bit to the question of, you know, many people like to say that NATO provoked this invasion, or somehow that the NATO enlargement provoked it. I would argue that certainly NATO enlargement irritated Putin. That's an undeniable fact. But I think much more important were the domestic developments inside inside Russia. And if Russia had continued on a democratic development and become a democracy, well, then there would have been, actually, it would have not been inconceivable that Russia could have joined NATO. And the fact that it became autocratic also made it see NATO more and more as an enemy. And a democratic Russia certainly would not have seen an alliance of democratic countries as an enemy, and it certainly would not have attacked a democratic Russia would certainly not have attacked a democratic neighbor, namely Ukraine. You mentioned some of the other events that that caused resentment in Putin. Certainly was the West's recognition of Kosovo's independence, which happened shortly before the 2008 NATO summit. It was also, of course, the Iraq invasion, and namely Russia's inability to influence events. During the Cold War, probably an invasion of this size, unilateral invasion by the United States, would have been very hard to imagine because the Soviet Union would have had much more say and much more clout in shaping events. And here Russia was completely powerless and had to watch the United States exercise its enormous military might. One thing I also want to say on the issue of NATO enlargement. In 2004, NATO enlarged and included the former Soviet republics of Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, the three Baltic nations. That was the first and only time that any former Soviet republics joined NATO. And in 2008, when Putin invaded Georgia, he effectively ended Georgia's bid for NATO because NATO was not enthusiastic about new members that have open territorial disputes. And the same thing happened in Ukraine in 2014 when Russia seized Crimea and helped foment an insurgency inside eastern Ukraine. Again, that effectively stopped Ukraine's movement into NATO. There was, after losing large chunks of territory, there was little chance that NATO was going to bring Ukraine into the alliance. So in essence, it was he had stopped, very effectively stopped NATO's enlargement into either of those countries. You ask about a misreading. I would say that this is, this story of Russia and Ukraine is all about misreadings and misinterpretations. And again, it's on two levels. I also think we need to look at what's happening in Ukraine and what Ukrainians are thinking and what's going on with the West. On one level, it was Putin misreading developments inside Ukraine. He knew the Ukraine of the Soviet time, when Ukraine was, after Russia, the most important Soviet republic. It was the largest in population. It was the breadbasket of the Soviet Union. It was an industrial powerhouse. It was really, for the Soviet Union, it was just one of the key elements in that state. What he did not understand, and I should add, of course, that Ukrainians, even if they speak Ukrainian at home, are usually fluent in Russia. So this gave Putin this idea that somehow, you know, Ukrainians were still very closely tied to Russia. They were, in fact. There were millions of Ukrainian migrant workers working in Russia. The border was, of course, open. There were all sorts of links, family links, business links. Volodymyr Zelensky made his fortune actually in the Russian TV market more than in the Ukrainian. So There were all these connections, but he didn't understand that Ukrainians, that there was a new generation of Ukrainians, coming of age, that did not see Russia as their model. The borders were open, and they saw countries, neighboring countries such as Poland and the Czech Republic, as models. As this is where they wanted to go. They were not interested in the kind of kleptocracy that Russia had become. So it was a misreading, thinking that Ukrainians are simply sort of Western Russians. That was a complete misreading, and that was a misreading already in 2014 when Russia began stoking tensions stoking this uprising in the Donbas. It certainly did not go the way that many people in Russia had hoped for, because Ukraine had already developed its own national identity, and there was a new generation of people, whether they spoke Russian or Ukrainian, who saw themselves as Ukrainians and wanted maybe good relations with Russia, but they wanted good relations with the West as well, and that's where they saw their future. The last thing I would say is that the misreading of the West's intention. I think this is one of the main points of my book. The real tragedy for Ukraine is that despite Putin's obsession with Ukraine and portraying it as kind of this American foothold in Russia's backyard, in fact, the United States did not care at all about Ukraine. This is the real tragedy. George W. Bush pushed for Ukraine's entry into NATO, but that was sort of as an afterthought and as a reward for participating in his catastrophic war in Iraq. And after George W. Bush, no American president could have cared less about Ukraine. That begins with Barack Obama, goes on to Donald Trump, and to the early months of the Joe Biden administration. Joe Biden was also not interested particularly in helping Ukraine. All of these presidents were interested in reaching a modus vivendi with Russia. Of course, that's a completely understandable goal if you're the Russia is still a peer nuclear power, and you want to somehow have a modicum of stability in that relationship. But at the same time, despite a lot of pompous declarations about Ukraine, in fact, there was no interest in bringing Ukraine into any of the Western institutions. And this is what this is for me. This is what is truly tragic, and certainly is the West's responsibility.
Thanks, Lucian. We're going to wrap it up soon, but I wanted to ask one follow-up question that I think you've answered to some degree already in some of your comments about the way Russia moved towards autocracy and kleptocracy. But one view that's developed, I think, since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine is that this, the war and the invasion, is kind of a, some people say the Soviet collapse was not finished, and this was a development, a further development in the collapse of the Soviet Union, essentially. Now, to me, I find that argument, I mean, to some degree, it's accurate in terms of this is an event that occurred after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and it involves former Soviet republics. But to me, it like hands Putin kind of an excuse, as if to say, well, that it was almost inevitable. So I guess that's my final question is, do you see it that way, or do you see what happened as something that definitely might not have happened in many kind of alternate realities, I guess?
Steve, I think the important to understand, I think also when we're looking back at history, when we look back at history, we see a series of events and we see a path. But we need to remember that nothing is inevitable. And I certainly would not agree that, you know, somehow this was preordained, this invasion was preordained. In fact, even if we look back at 2014, which is a large focus of my book, it appears that at that time, Putin was very interested in seizing Crimea. He saw Crimea as a rather exceptional place, a place that had been also part of Russia for a substantial amount of time. And he thought that Russia had a real claim on Crimea also because of its strategic importance as the historic base of the Russian Black Sea Fleet. As for the rest of Ukraine, certainly the Kremlin was involved in fomenting this insurgency. Russian troops also fought in eastern Ukraine. Regular Russian troops fought in eastern Ukraine in 2014. But it does not appear like he was interested in actually seizing that territory and incorporating it into Russia. Much more, the idea at that time in 2014 was to control these little statelets in Donetsk and Luhansk, to control those, but to leave them in Ukraine in order to maintain leverage over what happens in Kyiv. In other words, the Donbass inside Ukraine, but under Russian influence, would be able to veto any decisions taken by Kyiv that the Kremlin did not like. So even at that point, we were not on the path to a full-scale war. In the years following, when we had this very shaky peace agreement called the Minsk Accord, that certainly was one way of it was still an attempt by Russia to keep control over Ukraine, because that agreement envisioned the reintegration of Donetsk and Luhansk into Ukraine, and again as a Russian Trojan horse inside the Ukrainian state. When Volodymyr Zelensky became president, he was not interested in following this agreement. It had been really signed under gunpoint by his predecessor Petro Poroshenko, and Volodymyr Zelensky was interested in renegotiating the Minsk agreement. He was hopeful that maybe the United States, maybe also Great Britain and even Canada would be able to join, rather than just Germany and France as the guarantors of that. And that was unsuccessful. We need to remember that when Zelensky came into power in 2019, he was accused by his domestic opponents in Ukraine of being a Russian tool, of being too soft on Putin, that he wouldn't be able to stand up to him. And Zelensky did try. He met with Putin in December of 2019, after his election, and he certainly was interested in finding a peaceful solution. But again, the Kremlin had no reason to renegotiate the Minsk agreements. It really was a way of keeping Ukraine in check. You know, either Ukraine disavows the Minsk agreements and they're the violators, right? Or else they follow the Minsk agreements and they basically let this Russian Trojan horse into their state. So it was really an impossible catch-22. And so, you know, events continued, and probably one of the key moments, before the invasion was Zelensky's decision to put Putin's close Ukrainian associate, Viktor Medvedchuk, under house arrest, and to also close three TV channels that Medvedchuk controlled, to close those. And we know that this was also for Putin in many ways the last straw. And in some ways, I think you could say Putin understood at that moment that his levers of any kind of soft power within Ukraine were exhausted or simply not working anymore. And soon after that, we saw the first Russian buildup in the spring of 2021, followed by the second buildup in the fall of 2021, leading up to the full-scale invasion. I just want to circle back to what you said at the beginning about people calling it insane. It's not me calling this necessarily insane. I mean, the Russian state media were calling the idea that there would be an invasion insane. This decision to go into Ukraine took everybody by surprise, mm-hmm. except for a very small inner circle around Putin. And that's why the book is also called Putin's Revenge, right? I mean, it was essentially his decision, his years of offense, whether warranted or unwarranted, but years and years of perceived humiliation that finally burst out.
All right. Thank you very much, Lucian. We're going to wrap it up here, and that's where we are after what you called the impossible catch-22 that Ukraine found itself in, even before the full-scale invasion. Lucian, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Okay, once again, I've been speaking to Lucian Kim, senior analyst for Ukraine at the Crisis Group, and the author of the brand new book, Putin's Revenge, Why Russia Invaded Ukraine. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.